Welcome to Talking Cybersecurity, a weekly podcast listened to in over 50 countries. My name is Richard Herron and I am your presenter. In the Talking Cybersecurity podcast, expect to hear all things related to the cybersecurity industry, whether that's getting your first job, interviews, board reports, data breaches, different approaches to cybersecurity, or conferences. None of the opinions expressed on this podcast by myself or guests are necessarily reflective of the opinions of the organisations we represent. If you want to continue the conversation, feel free to join the LinkedIn group, Talking Cybersecurity. I use Pixabay for most of the music heard on this podcast. Hi everyone, as we've been saying over the last few weeks, ni hao. Welcome back to Talking Cybersecurity, episode 63. Today is Sunday, March 10, 2024. Happy birthday to anyone who is having a birthday today. Hope you're all well, and if you're in Melbourne, there's one word, heat. I hope you are keeping cool. It has been very hot, and we're in the middle of a bit of a heat wave in Melbourne. When it's the high 30 degrees Celsius during the day and high 20 degrees Celsius at night, it becomes a little bit unbearable. Enough about the weather. Today we will complete our two-part series on data loss protection. Sometimes when you do a podcast episode, imposter syndrome kicks in and you start wondering whether an episode you've just recorded would help anyone. And this is certainly what I felt last week. However, having put together this week's episode and reflecting on part one from last week, I do declare that the information imparted over the past 2 weeks about DLP will help at least one of you. So with that, on to part two of our discussion about data loss protection, and we'll continue where we left off after week one. Detects people that use processes that aren't necessarily secure. So here's a classic example. During COVID times, we know lots of people worked at home regularly. So I've been told this from a reliable source, that this one person was about to do a big confidential presentation the next day at work. So today they were at home working on the presentation, and tomorrow they were going in to do their big presentation. They realised they didn't have the resources at home to print the reports in, you know, nice, shiny, glossy colour, and they realised that they'd be cutting it a little bit short the next day if they got to work early enough to print off everything they needed to print off. So what did they do? They sent their confidential presentation to their partner to print off. Now, to be fair, I'm sure a number of listeners have done this before. The problem was that their partner worked for a very big rival to their partner's company, and he'd basically sent her a list of all the strategic customers, their contact details, some private information about them from their CRM system, etc. You may not know this, but a number of organisations look for emails from competitors. This person's spouse did and discovered the many strategic secrets of the other company. If I've explained that clearly enough, you can probably predict the outcome. Yes, another casualty of DLP. In another example, a staff member was detected uploading an assignment to the university. No crime in that. It is not a hanging offence. But when you use the real data of 5,000 customers in your spreadsheet, we have a problem. And I believe due to the age of the staff member, they were given an absolute first and final warning on that behaviour. You can't go attaching real customer records to your university assignment in Excel, or any other tool for that matter. Again, do you see that a lot of this isn't necessarily malicious behaviour? It's just people not realising that they're putting your company's reputation in jeopardy by sending all this stuff out. There have been stories of people sending their yearly appraisal home. Seems innocent enough, doesn't it? But think about your appraisal. It can contain strategic plans for the next year or strategic things you've worked on. Given that companies have had and will continue to have a number of incidents where documents have been sent to the wrong address, you really need to protect these documents and possibly don't go sending your appraisal home or any other work-related documentation of that matter. While I'm at it, a rule to protect passport numbers is worth considering. What a great way to potentially detect identity theft and help with anti-money laundering efforts. So, there are a few stories, and I'm going to talk about a few real gotchas. Initial communication with the business. In the very early days, you probably want to present something to your business, re-DLP. Alas, unless you can show a screenshot of incidents, it's going to be hard to get the attention of the staff. There just won't be anything particularly tangible for them to grasp. Showing them a report of senders, though, it is amazing how attached to DLP and how interested in DLP they finally become, especially when they see their own staff members' names on it. So that'd just be like a proof of concept report. Proof of concept is critical for DLP. It will really act as the business case to get you over the line. A people leaders pack, like in PowerPoint presentation, may be good to introduce early in the piece. Create a DLP business steering committee. You've got to get one representative from each of the areas of your business. And look, they may provide you with their lowest common denominator as a representative. Ask for a risk person to be on your steering committee. As you progress, you'll have something more tangible to show them, and that will pique their interest. As I said, it's only when people see names and associated incidents that they become very interested and start suggesting to you DLP rules that would benefit their business. What policy should you start off with? Look, credit card numbers are always a good one. It always gets down to what info you don't want to see ever flowing from your organisation, or at least flowing unprotected from your organisation. And I'm going to give you a list of rules towards the end of this episode I would suggest you would put in. In the very early days, you'll also find your steering committee are going to be very hesitant in wanting to block data leaving their organisation. It's also very important to determine your incident management process. At the start, you really won't appreciate what a DLP incident is, i.e. is it someone sending credit card numbers to an organisation as part of a business process? Is it someone sending data to another organisation unencrypted? Is it someone sending confidential data home? What about if they sent their own health record, superannuation record, or bank statement home? In the end, you'll probably accept that there are valid business processes resulting in confidential data being sent out externally, but how they send it is another question. When I say how, I mean secure or insecurely. You should always ask yourself, has the sender got the right to hold the data? Has the recipient the right to receive it? Is the transmission method safe? Those three questions are the crux of DLP to me. So you know what? I'm going to repeat them again. You should always ask yourself, has the sender got the right to hold the data? Has the recipient the right to receive it? And is the transmission method safe? Always have your security team contact the staff member's manager when they find something to validate, whether it is BAU or whether it's something, maybe something a bit sinister about it. So bottom line, define what an incident is, then decide who to tell. Problem with incident management is the consequences. I have seen people treated differently who have done similar things, but that's just the way it goes sometimes in life. Impact on business processes. You just won't have the resources to identify every business process. So you'll probably just concentrate on changing the end component of the processes, i.e. when you're about to transmit the confidential data, getting people thinking whether they need to send the data. If they do, have they protected it in some form, MS passwords, PGP, etc., which certainly protects against sending the data to the wrong destination. Some destinations stop traffic that is encrypted as it cannot be inspected for viruses. Just means the recipient has to send a please release email to the email administrator. Or protected in transit, i.e. TLS. It protects risk of interception, which is actually extremely low. People not sending data home, instead they've used encrypted USB keys or used a VPN, which is a bit safer than just sending data home. Now, I've mentioned a few lessons before, but I'll give you some more. Early lessons, policies, you will need exemptions, i.e. whitelists of people. Could be a board member, say. You don't want to be hassling these people why they sent something home. Sure, it should be one rule for all, but that doesn't always happen. If you're looking for certain data types, ignore, say, 1-4 credit card numbers. They're typically people sending their bank statements home. Otherwise, you're going to be flooded with incidents. I've seen one organisation that banned all tax file numbers sending home. And it was crazy because, you know, at tax time, people are perhaps sending their information to their accountant. They need to send their tax file number. So just be very careful and perhaps in some cases a little bit lenient with the number of data types that you want alerted on. You will need to work with your privacy department. Keep them informed. Ask them whether your monitoring is breaching privacy and whether there are any communications that have to go out reminding staff that, you know, we monitor emails. You will always find people working from home and therefore emailing stuff home. And there are solutions to this. Business steering committees aren't always overly effective early on. You may not have the right people to start with. Some just don't want to be there, some won't listen, and others just won't understand it. Over time, you will get the right people though. If I could have my time again for every DLP rollout I've been involved in, I probably would make sure that all the reps on the business steering committee were at a certain level of responsibility. You may not have the right reporting to start with. The inbuilt graphs, etc. may not give you what you're after. You need to extract data, link it to an HR system so you can nut out exactly who the senders are, their business unit, their sub-business unit, their sub-sub-business unit, who their manager is, etc. And you'll be able to extract that data out of a SAP or an HR system like that. Otherwise, you just can't identify who they are, where they live, and what processes are putting you at risk. Business steering committee will give you the governance, but you need to get risk managers on board as well. They will be your enforcers when you start sending out the monthly reports to each business unit. You will make some really bad assumptions at the start. Trust me on that, i.e. here's a typical graph, the numbers are high this month, but given some comms, the numbers will plummet by month three. They won't. Change does take time. But if you can afford it, get someone on board as a contractor who's been through all this before and who understands DLP. Maybe someone can contact me in about 10 years when it's time for me to retire. I really do enjoy DLP. Review what you've done, maybe 6 monthly. So after 6 months, review your incidents. Are there still many false positives affecting your view? And you do get false positives, trust me. Are there incidents that you've actually perhaps accidentally detected that need to be in a rule in their own right? Do you need to ramp up blocking? Do you want to introduce alerting? So blocking blocks the data going out. Alerting actually alerts the user and says, hey, it looks like you're sending out a tax file number. Do you really want to do this? You go, yes. And that'll ask you to justify why the system should allow you to send out that data type. So that's alerting. Now, what's important is education. So what education strategies can you use? Well, attend team meetings spreading the word, i.e. what is information loss, and give them some examples. If you have any organisation-specific examples, especially from your own organisation, you'll probably get much better interest. What's the risk? So that's the what's in it for me type question, what can I do about it, etc. Attend risk and compliance forums. Similar to the approach above, you tell them what information loss is, you give them some examples, you talk about the risk, etc. Training, build it into some of your, or all of your, mandatory compliance, risk and security awareness training you do throughout the year. Internet site. So a site that talks about what data loss is, examples, and have some collateral, how to protect Microsoft Word documents, etc. In fact, one place I was involved with data loss, they put all these how to protect your documents on the internet site, and wow, there was a lot of traffic going through that site. So people want to do the right thing. They may just not know how to do the right thing. You really need this because people will say to you, okay, you tell me to protect the data, but how do I protect the data? And don't answer with AES256. You've got to give them something that they can use. So you might even think about a video clip on your corporate intranet where you could have, say, your chief security officer, CIO, CEO, etc., talk about data loss, what it is, why it's important, and what you can do about it. You might also think about a background image on your corporate PC. So a lot of companies use the background image on their PCs to spread the word about something topical. You could have some data loss image and words and link to your internet site there. A lot of this is just asking staff who have been sending data insecurely for the past 10, 20, 30 years, or copying confidential data to insecure USB sticks for years, just to stop and think about what they're doing. Let's talk about activation of policies. Which ones should you turn on first? Well, depends on what you want to achieve and what your organization's like, I guess. Do you want to comply with certain regulations? Do you want to detect fraud? Are there privacy issues? Are there PCI DSS issues? Just remember, a lot of people start with credit card number detection. If you do that, be careful what you wish for. Because if you activate that credit card number rule, you will have yourself a PCI DSS problem. You've got to act on it. I'm not saying don't turn on the credit card number rule, and I'm not saying, oh, don't turn it on because you'll find there's credit card numbers there and you want to hide them. I'm not saying that at all. All I'm saying is, when you start detecting credit card numbers on your network, you have a PCI DSS problem and you must do something about it. So policies I've put in place before, and this is really Australian based, this is sort of the order of activation I would more than likely put in place. Numero uno, pick a PII policy. There are out-of-the-box policies that show you personally identifiable information that's copied to USB keys or emailed. It looks for the characteristics such as name, address, date of birth, gender, sex, etc., etc. Given that we've had that many data breaches with PII data, surely the PII data rule would be your first pick. Secondly, I'd probably go for the credit card number data rule. So this has PCI DSS implications, as I've just mentioned, and it may be a good catch-all if the PII rule doesn't pick up a major exfiltration. Any emails greater than, say, 50 megabytes would be a good rule to deploy. Why so? Well, you really want to know early on if there is a mass exfiltration of information. In fact, this could be a blocking rule, and you mightn't even need DLP for it. You might be able to use your email product to do this. But yeah, I'd probably say if anyone's sending out more than 30 megabytes, 40 megabytes, block that transmission, because that almost reeks of a data breach to me. Being in Australia, I'd probably throw in tax file numbers, Medicare numbers. Now, here's an interesting one for you, and a bit controversial. People of interest. Quite often, fraud departments or HR will want intelligence on certain internal staff members. Maybe they're acting erratically, say. Maybe money's gone missing. Monitoring these persons of interest will assist them, but obviously you need to get the written consent from human resources. You don't want to break any privacy laws, nor do you want 101 security analysts monitoring all these people's emails. Destinations of interest is interesting, he says, because you might want to set up a rule where emails to competitors are flagged. Along the same interest, documents of interest. You can do that with what's called watermarking them. And a board paper might be an example of a document of interest. You want to see if that leaves your organisation. Email auto forwarders. Don't get me started. You may want to identify and stop people who auto forward emails to other email addresses. So contractors typically tend to do this because they don't want to log in to two different email addresses. Interim financial results. Now, I saw this rule in place once where a staff member from the finance department sent the details of the company's interim financial results that were confidential. He sent them to a friend and said, "Ooh, our figures haven't been announced yet, but they look good. Jump onto our shares." Let's just say that finance person was exited from the organisation within 24 hours. Password protection of documents and emails. So this is a rule, and whereas it's good practice to password protect documents when you send them out, you might just want to keep an eye on this. You know, is someone trying to hide something, or, to be fair, are they just trying to protect a business document they send to a customer? Risk papers. This is very similar to the board papers rule I talked about. So you might want to merge your risk papers and your board report data rule into the one. You know, do you really want externals reading about your organization's risks or your board papers? Probably not. And I'm sure there are so many other rules that you can put in place that are important to your organization. Actually, I'll leave you with one more policy you may want to consider. You may want to detect when one of your staff members uploads a file to one of those PDF creation manipulation sites. Why would you want a rule like that? Number one, you don't know where your potentially confidential information is being stored before it does this PDF creation or manipulation. And number two, in the very fine print of some of these sites, and I kid you not, it does state, this information can be shared with others if you don't click this little checkbox. So the rule might say something like, block emails to word2pdf.com or something like that. Or these days there might be an out-of-the-box rule to cater for something like that. But please look for people who are uploading documents to those PDF creation sites. And obviously attach some security awareness on that as well. Believe it or not, I could go on for years about data loss protection. It's something I really do like having governance over. Apart from learning the inner workings of your company's processes, you have the power to further secure your company by reviewing all this data that's been copied to USB keys or sent out in email. And that's what security is all about, isn't it? Protecting corporate and customer information. Or do you agree with the person who emphatically told me last week that security was all about maintaining certifications? We do live in a democracy, my friends, with a reasonable amount of freedom of speech, so I guess there may be no definitive answer to the question, what is security all about? Anyways, that was the episode on DLP. Well, that wraps up our discussion on DLP. I hope it helped at least one of you. Next week is round one of the AFL, and I'll definitely be at the MCG and the members with my friend Paul to watch my team Essendon beat Paul's team, Hawthorn. We've been talking about the game for weeks, so it'll be great to catch up and watch the game. Public holiday tomorrow, woohoo! And I'm personally lucky to have next Friday off as well. I better go, SISO Melbourne 2024 is coming up. It just seems like the other day that we covered SISO Melbourne 2023. But no, this year is 2024, so it will be SISO Melbourne 2024. And a few of my associates, Sarah, Nigel, Indika and others, are presenting there. It's a great event to attend if you can. Something quite important has popped up for me on that day, so I may be a no-show. But all the best with all your presentations, especially Sarah, Nigel and Indika. With that, I'd better go. Have a great week. See ya. Bye.